Meeting will come to order, and good to see everybody here, and thank you very much for attending today. And we're hoping that we'll have some more members kind of trickling in as we go along, but we want to get started because we are on kind of a tight timeline today, and most of you know that we also have another hearing this afternoon kind of on a very closely related topic. So we wanted to get started to learn a little bit more about how chemical dependency services are funded in the state and what's going on in the field, because frankly the news in the state around this topic hasn't really been so good. We're hearing that we have growing problems with chemical dependency in various kinds. We've, as everybody knows, we've got a lot going on in healthcare and how it's funded, and we thought it would be a really good time to get some background so that everybody has sort of a basis of knowledge about what we're doing currently, and hopefully that will encourage members to think about you know, working on ways we might improve our system, ways we might give better services to people in our state, ways we might think better about using our funds for prevention, or who knows, maybe we're doing everything just right. I don't know, but I thought it would be a good thing to take this opportunity during the interim when there's a little bit less time pressure, and obviously members are also working and they have other things to do. So I assume that we're being taped here, so this will be available for members as well. But so we have some presenters today to try to catch us up on what's been going on in the state around this very important topic. So welcome, Commissioner Hartford, and or I should say Assistant Commissioner, and if you would just introduce yourself and go ahead and begin your presentation. Unless Representative Huntley has anything, comments? No. Okay. Very good. And then I think, is it your preference that if we have questions that we interrupt during the presentation?
Madam Chair, anytime.
Anytime. Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity. I'm Dave Hartford, DHS Assistant Commissioner of Chemical and Mental Health Services. And this morning, I will be presenting really an overview of a number of different topics associated with substance abuse dependence. And first, a quick overview of the objectives. I'll do a little bit of a summary of current chemical dependency system and its challenges, some discussion about integration and what that means with the healthcare changes in healthcare delivery system, and then to view a projected timeline, to talk about a timeline about how might we approach some of the changes that we need to do in the system. So one of the things to consider, I think, in this is we've had a lot of discussion about what does it mean for substance abuse? Why do we need to integrate substance abuse dependence into healthcare? Well, it's because it's clearly not part of the healthcare delivery system. Over the years, we've clearly developed an additional system for delivery of substance abuse services, a third rail, if you will, that's not part of mainstream healthcare. So we have an opportune time now, as a lot of the research is coming forward, as to what does that mean today? What are the opportunities today? And one of the big ones is the Affordable Care Act. It has now given us a whole new set of possibilities. And I'm just going to touch very briefly on some of these. One is the concept of expanded coverage, especially for kids and for single adults. Now the opportunity for federal funding is going to come forward to us starting in January for several key populations that utilize substance dependency services. Likewise, nationally, from a coverage standpoint, it's estimated that 38 million Americans will be covered by the ACA, and as much as 11 million of them have behavior health issues. So it's really disproportionately will advantage people with substance abuse dependence, advantage from the standpoint of having services that weren't currently available in the past. Likewise, there's an opportunity to build on the work that's been done around parity. And then the last one I'm just going to highlight innovation. I've been in the field of substance abuse dependence and mental health for many years, and have always, the Centers for Medicaid Services, CMS, federal government regulating these areas, I've really experienced them as a regulatory agency. The fact that now CMS is taking a position and really giving direction to be innovative, to change the way we approach healthcare, especially in the areas of behavioral health, we have new tools and opportunities that are coming our way to take a look at how do we better meet the needs of people with substance abuse disorders. Likewise, SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Administration, the federal arm of the federal government that oversees chemical and mental health services, is clearly signaling us to operate differently in these arenas, both in our federal block grant and in the way we do business. So there's this whole concept of innovation that's being pushed from the federal government, if you will, our way. And again, this whole theme of reform, the need to reform the substance abuse delivery system, if you take a look, we've been on this path for a long time now, all the way back to 1999, and this list is all federal initiatives. When the Surgeon General's report came out then, was the first time really came forward saying substance abuse is a treatable condition. We know this from a medical standpoint. You know, historically, a lot of disorders, let's say like substance abuse, mental illness, we didn't have a lot of knowledge. The mind was a little bit of a black box, and all we could do is observe behaviors and make our best guesses to what was going on. And that's not the case anymore. Science has advanced clearly over the last 30 years with all of the imaging technology, genetic technology that we have. We clearly understand substance abuse as a disease, treatable disease, with outcomes that are actually at least as good and better as the treatment for other chronic diseases. So again, back to 1999, Surgeon General report stating that it was treatable. Move forward to 03, the President's New Freedom report talked about system transformation, and the concept of recovery was really put forward at a national level. Move forward to 2008, the Wellstone-Domenici Act, talking about federal parity, brought that forward, that the mental health substance abuse should be treated on par with other medical conditions. 09, the concept from the Institute of the Health Care Institute, the triple aim, better health, improved quality, and lower cost, as inherent in all areas. And then lastly, like I said, the Affordable Care Act in 2010 kind of brought us full circle on moving along the reform pathway. And I'm going to put forward today to just kind of restate some of the challenges that we have today, often are not spoken about very much, and I just kind of want to bring these forward, that substance abuse treatment over time has clearly been isolated and segregated, like the mental health delivery system, into a third rail system, if you will. And historically, you know, it was only a couple of years ago that Governor Pawlenty gave a formal apology for the way people with mental illness were treated in our state institutions. So this is relatively recent history. If you look across the country today, LA County Jail is now the largest mental health facility in the country. If you look at our jails across the country, they're filled. We're number one in the world with people incarcerated for substance abuse because of substance abuse charges directly related to their addiction. So we're housing people, and that treatment mentality. And even if we get to our own, so the big story here that I wanted to get through to people, I think many of us have worked hard over the years to build systems to assure that people get care for substance abuse dependence, as a for instance. But the systems were built in other eras when we knew much less, and the ability to pass laws to create funding streams to treat individuals has really changed dramatically. And some of the systems that we built are actually creating a, create a barrier today to full integration into healthcare. And I wanted to kind of point this out because as we look at a transformation of substance abuse dependence, it's more than just adding on fixes, which is what tends to happen over time. We really have to take a look at what are the things in place that may need to get out of the way, if you will, in order to have full integration with healthcare and fully treat substance abuse dependence as the chronic disease that it is. Again, I'll point out one other just point here. If you take a look at what medical condition do you know of that you would go to the county, your local county, to be screened and to assess what level of medical care you need for that care. And I really can't think of a single one where it's appropriate to go to through county social service for a diagnosis or an assessment for a level of care. Last session, Senator Marty brought forward a bill on schizoaffective disorder in order to access a set of benefits. Again, I kind of challenge, what have you ever heard of a heart condition where we're going to add a procedure and it comes to the legislature to consider, should we allow this particular kind of bypass surgery? Is this diagnosis? But yet in the area of mental health and substance abuse, we bring forward and really make determinations from a cost standpoint, from a political standpoint, what shouldn't be treated as what is clearly has been become known as a disease. And how do we get this condition clearly into healthcare at all levels, I think is one of the challenges that we're faced with today. So why do we care? Well, in addition to the human cost, the lost lives that we could certainly talk about, purely from a financial standpoint, it's estimated more than $500 billion a year to the country nationally. Substance abuse addiction costs, it's estimated as much as 15% of state budgets go to crime, criminal justice costs, and health care costs. Studies show us a dollar spent on effective school-based care saves as much as $18 in later problems. This is really that leveraging of issues around kids and their development of substance abuse dependence. I will not go into that very much this morning, but we'll talk more this afternoon directly related to synthetics and go into that in more detail this afternoon. And lastly, a dollar spent on treatment, this has been around for many years, is a great return on investment, $12 in reduction in related costs of crime, criminal justice, health care. I added this list to kind of share. These are the topics that keep me up at night, so I thought I would share them with you. the first being adolescent prevention and treatment. Again, we know through the brain science that kids are most impacted by risky substance use. We know that if kids do not use alcohol, tobacco, or other drugs by age 21, it's a very slight chance they will ever develop dependence. So we know we have to intervene in a better way at that age, and there's a number of reasons. These young developing brains are impacted by substance use, their judgment, they're at an age of development where novel, risky behavior looks attractive, they're in points of life where transition is apparent and they become exposed to these drugs, so a very important topic. That's opiates and synthetics, both significant issues for this population. Detoxification services, we know we've got a growing problem around detoxification services, withdrawal management in the state. We've gone from 30 licensed detox programs in the state to 22 over the last 10 years. We're seeing more and more issues related to law enforcement, transportation, a variety of different issues. We know we've got housing issues around people with chronic substance dependence. a variety of issues around access to services, workforce issues, like other areas of behavioral health. We have an aging workforce, and the aspects of the Accountable Care Act, it's anticipated we'll have coverage and dollars for many more services. Well, in order to deliver services, you have to have the workforce to do that. And we know we have shortages all the way from psychiatry, all the way to peer supports across the spectrum of behavioral health and substance abuse jobs. So it's a huge issue. And if we talk about changing the paradigm for substance abuse so that we start to treat it more as a chronic disease, which it is, as opposed to episodes of acute care, we know we need to take a look at that substance, the workforce of substance abuse counselors. And then lastly, we know that we need to do continued work around culturally specific and culturally competent services. Another shift that's occurred is just within the last couple of months, the Obama administration has put forward a new national drug control strategy, has really moved away from, not to say enforcement is still not a key component of the strategy, but has really moved to strengthen prevention efforts, to seek earlier intervention opportunities, integrate, again, these same themes keep coming back over and over again, integrate substance abuse into the healthcare system and improve our ability to do data analytics and outcome measurement around substance dependence. Another thing that's changed in the environment recently is what I refer to as a new recovery movement. You know, historically, the anonymous Alcoholics Anonymous and kind of a feature of substance abuse dependence was that people didn't talk about the fact that they had dependence issues. And so there wasn't a lot of natural advocacy groups. I mean, like I said, I've worked in these fields for a long time, and they're really, other than providers, not natural advocacy groups like there is for other disability groups. But that has shifted today, and it's been recognized there's a new movement nationally that really is talking about people in long-term recovery coming forward, not being anonymous, kind of bringing forward the changes in education around recovery and how the millions and millions of people that are in long-term recovery today. In Minnesota, the recovery movement is alive and well. We now have three organizations in Minnesota developing peer support systems and education and kind of bring substance abuse dependence, if you will, into the light so that people can understand in a better way. We had our third annual walk in the state just a couple of weekends ago. Again, thousands of people participating in that walk. And a little bit different focus. This new recovery movement also focuses on wellness, physical and emotional wellness. So what do we know? I mentioned earlier about the new science. What does science actually tell us? That a number of members attended Wake Forest, sponsored a conference last summer for legislators around what's the new science around substance dependence. And one is the whole concept of the brain hijacking, and that's what I was saying. The imaging technology today is phenomenal, where you can now we can study and see exactly what areas of the brain get hijacked, if you will, in the decision making, and why the decision making process works the way it does to develop substance dependence. We know that genetics can predispose people to addiction. We know that the environment, that a person's genetics, how those genes are expressed is impacted by a person's environment, that adolescents are particularly vulnerable to drugs, as I said. Big feature here, drug addiction needs to be treated as a chronic disease to be effective because relapse is common. Like any other chronic health condition, with an expectation, if you will, It's kind of like my cancer may return. My diabetes may flare up, may change. My heart condition, I may need another procedure in time. Like any of these conditions, relapse is common, and we need to create systems that address that. Talk a little bit about Minnesota leadership. I think it's fair to say, if you look at the healthcare data today, Minnesota clearly is always at the head of the pack. And I have to say, it's fun when I go to conferences nationally, because we do a better job of coming together around complex issues than anybody. Likewise, in the area of substance abuse over the years, the Minnesota model, and again in the area of substance abuse, came from Willmar State Hospital, Hazelden. The reason it was called the Minnesota model and really launched the national, it was a multidisciplinary approach, was the first really therapeutic approach to substance abuse in the country, and every state emulated what we did here in Minnesota. Likewise, the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Fund was cutting edge when that was created, because we assured access to substance abuse treatment for income-eligible people. Even to this day, it puts us in advantage over many states that never did that kind of work, because we currently are much closer, if you will, to meeting the demand for what is possible under ACA than many other states that never made those investments. We're in much better shape. But the thing with these couple of features, the Minnesota model was 1955. If you look at that, that's 55 years ago. What has changed in our technology and our view of the world today? Likewise, our funding stream that we created in the Consolidated Fund, this is many years ago, and the concepts and the tools that we had that we funded under that are now quite old. A couple of other firsts. Right now we're rolling out the first in the country integrated dual diagnosis treatment rule. And likewise, I'll touch bases for just a minute, last year we launched, to my knowledge, it's the first multi-agency strategic framework in the country. As I spoke with others at national conferences, the idea that we brought together our state agencies to start to take on this huge issue that has multiple agencies involved is really a first of its kind. And you can see from the slides all of what we've got, eight state agencies working together, meeting monthly along with work groups. We're almost a year old now, just came together last year, anticipating to put together a one-year report as to accomplishments out of that group. Again, talking about that, there's a strategic framework that was put together, really kind of a long-term framework. At the top of that list was the opiate prescription drug issue in the state. There's been a work group in particular working on that, making headway with our prescription monitoring program, working at safety issues around safety and overdose deaths, educating our physicians around prescribing practices, so a whole variety of different energies, if you will, trying to take on that opiate issues. Next, let me touch bases quickly again on the go back to the funding picture here a little bit and talk about the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Fund. Again, in its day, this was a very innovative, cutting-edge concept to create a braided funding stream that incorporated county dollars, and we run approximately 20% county dollars, federal block grant dollars, and state appropriation to pay for substance abuse treatment. The other thing, let me kind of jump forward so you can kind of see this slide as to how, because one of the features that we know is going to happen to the fund over time here is because of the expansion of healthcare dollars in expansion population, we will start to see a decrease and share for counties and for state as our as the federal share starts to grow. And I won't go into this too far right now. We'll get into the weeds with this quite some distance. But that's one of the points to it, is that we're going to see a decrease in the need for the fund to pay for treatment. And lastly, as I said earlier, the SAMHSA has given us direction about their share of the federal block grant that we receive. We've historically used a significant amount of our block grant to pay for treatment. SAMHSA has now given a signal to us that we need to start to change the way we use our block grant dollars for recovery support services and really start to pay for treatment out of health care dollars. As opposed to,
and Mr. Hardin, could you tell us what SAMHSA is?
Excuse me. Yeah. Again, it's the federal government. It's the arm, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, and they are really the again the arm of the federal government that regulates and that we work with closely around our federal block grant. So that signal is, again, that's a federal direction is, and I think from. Just for me to explain this a little bit, historically, we've tended to take healthcare dollars, social service dollars in this area of substance dependence and kind of blur the line, if you will, and not really be able to tell what's healthcare and what's social services. So this is an opportunity, I think SAMHSA is sending this clear signal, put into healthcare what's healthcare dollars. And consider social services, and in this area, use your federal block grant dollars for recovery support services, prevention, housing, other items that are not clearly not health care. So we've got some opportunities here, and again, back to that kind of signaling of what are some of the things that we need to accomplish. And now let me go to some of the history. I think some of the pressure that we've had over time.
There's a question from Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Hartford. I'd like to better understand the transition we're making, because now health care reform, all policies will cover chemical dependency treatment in some form. But in the past, I know that a lot of the people who are treated, and I think at one time it was a majority of the people treated under the Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund were actually people who had insurance, but they had exceeded, you know, the limits on it. As you say, relapse is common, and many people are not, you know, successful after the first round of treatment, and yet there was oftentimes limitations on their insurance coverage such that they were not able to reaccess that health benefit. And can you tell us a little bit about what we might expect? I've forgotten exactly what the CD benefit is under the minimums that's offered right now, but can you tell us a little bit about why you think there still won't be as much need for health care coverage? Is repeat treatment going to be available for people under the private insurance?
Representative Loeffler, Madam Chair.
Mr. Hartford.
I think that I wasn't saying that there is to be a decrease in the need for treatment per se. I think the model of treatment, instead of, as I said before, I think a lot of people did repeats in the same modes of treatment over and over again in the past because we only had a couple of options. Under the consolidated fund, there's inpatient care, there's outpatient care, and there is medication-assisted care. And that's actually the next piece that I was going to speak to here a little bit about a recognition that there were other services needed. And I think the coverage, so I'm going to talk about the services a little bit and the funding for them. I've asked someone from a managed care plan actually to follow up for a couple of minutes with me this morning. Carrie Zarbach is going to follow up just a little bit about from the managed care standpoint. But I think it will ultimately be less expensive if we give people what they need when they need it. So it's not a reduction in the amount of services. It's more about giving people the right service when they need it over time. So I don't know if I addressed that, your question or not there.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just continuing to want to learn about, you know, sort of what is the benefit set that we can expect and whether or not we are going to see people with private insurance continuing to look to this fund to pay for backup treatment to when they exceed their benefit levels. And I'm just, because of all the changes with federal health care reform, I'm just not clear in my mind about what we can expect now in terms of the private insurance for this and to what degree people will still continue to shift onto publicly subsidized treatment because they haven't been cured or they have relapsed after exhausting their private coverage.
So, mm-hmm. Mr. Hartford, and that kind of fits in with something that I wanted to ask as well, which is to ask you to just say a few more words about what it means to have parity. You know, we hear about that. We've got now, because of the Wellstone Act, we have parity with mental health. But what does that really mean? So I think it kind of fits together here with Representative Loeffler's question. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, in the fact that here in the state of Minnesota, we will have an established benefit set that all plans across all plans, all individuals will have the same benefit set is really where it, so there won't be some groups excluded because for chemical dependency, not because of pre-existing condition or cost, that will have parity across all of the plans. So this should be a level playing field. So when we talk about establishing new services, I would expect these services to be available to individuals regardless of what plan they were in or how they were being managed, because we have a common, at least from a dollar standpoint, a common parity.
Right, and maybe I sidetracked you a bit from Representative Loeffler's question about, but maybe you'll get to that later, about whether our consolidated fund is still going to be needed to care for people who exceed their, if there's still a limit in their treatment under the Affordable Care Act, whether we're going to still need that fund, if I'm understanding the question,
that's
Representative
correct.
Loeffler. So maybe, hopefully we'll get to that, but why don't you
Madam
march
just
ahead
very
here.
Briefly. So there's nothing being presented that we're going to end the fund, but I think transitioning, and I'll get to that as
okay.
I kind of go
and
through.
Excuse me, we do have a couple more questions, so maybe this would be a good point to get to those. Okay. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And from PPACA, provisions in the rules that have come from it, what are the impacts with these readmission? You know, there's readmission guidelines and rules that are coming into effect in hospitals. And you have relapses and other things that you've touched upon. Is there any difficulties you foresee from those provisions in this type of treatment?
Representative Madam Chair. What's being proposed, I think, in these pilots is really more flexibility, that as people present with a need for services, that there's more options. It's really about having more options instead of only being admitted to a program and having to go through the same set of doors. It's having more tools so that primary care physicians, there's many other right doors for people to go through to get the services that they need.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my concern is if we need to have exemptions for some of the guys, there's a push to the PPACA in order to get better quality and outcomes and prevent just, you know, fee-for-service propagation of costs, that we do a better job of treatment and they look at percentage of readmissions. And I've got many hospitals, rural, small, and we've got a somewhat larger hospital that, you know, we share down in Olmsted. And I think we need to be proactive, that as we get more creative, that we avoid a pitfall from the implementation that appears to be coming next year. And I see that this is an area, especially with that readmission, that's sort of a little bit scary, and I'm not sure what the penalty is but there are penalties associated with. I haven't memorized the entire thousands of pages of, you know, rules that are propagated, but I think it'd behoove us to, as we review these, look at what might be needed and requested, you know, from the federal level to allow us to implement this, help our citizens, but avoid possible pitfalls from PPACA.
So as I'm understanding the question, I think Representative Quam is concerned about the penalties for readmission for the same illness. That is it to there to encourage hospitals to get it right the first time, and whether that would intersect with this, that we're going now with the idea that this is a chronic disease, that one visit doesn't do it, or one hospitalization is not going to be the end all, and whether those two things are going to be in conflict. I think that's Representative Quam. Did I more or less restate it,
Mr. Madam Chair? I think it's very important. The payment mechanisms that we, as we move forward with health care reform, are going to be very important. But I think it exemplifies my point in that in the old system, there was one option. Somebody went into the hospital. They didn't succeed, so that meant a readmission to the hospital because that was the only tool available. Moving forward, so unless we create other options, so when somebody's discharged from the hospital, the plan is if a relapse occur, you're going to get this lower level of service besides being readmitted to the hospital, will be a cost savings and would not create a readmission to the hospital. So until we start to create some other alternatives to admission to the hospital, as a for instance, we're going to continue to do the same thing over and over again of struggle with readmissions because we're not getting people the services they need and the alternative services in the community. So we keep doing, again, that acute care model where it means you go to the hospital over and over again as opposed to getting your services met in other less expensive alternatives.
Okay, we have a couple more questions, and just looking at your slides, Mr. Hartford, I see that you're kind of close to the end.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, I don't know, Representative Mullery's next, is it, you want to ask it now, Representative Mullery?
Preferably, since we're on the subject.
Okay.
And it's a, I think, a quick question or a quick answer. A couple years ago, I was working with the Juvenile Justice Coalition, and they were bringing up the problem with we could do screening, the counties could do the screening, but they were, we tried to put in that they also had to do the full assessment then if there was an indication on the screening, which apparently was very costly, and insurance wasn't covering it, so they blocked that going through. Does the new insurance, I can't figure out everything under the new rules. Does that cover so that the insurance policy will cover that so it's not a new additional cost that would be stuck on the counties?
Representative Mullery, Madam Chair.
Mr. Hartford.
Under the proposal for the model of care pilot, yes, that would address that so that people would get assessments at their point of access.
Thank you.
As opposed to point of access, county appointment, return to a provider. So yes.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Fisher, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to make sure I'm understanding up to this point, is basically you've been kind of covering is that in the current system for substance chemical dependency, we've been treating it just on a short term, in and out, and it's a chronic disease that needs to be taken a look and transforming how we're treating it more into a long-term program. Correct.
That's correct.
And so what you're saying is the current system is making it. We need to get to a new system. And am I correct to assume that these next slides you're going to be going into is going to kind of start outlining what this new system is going to need to look like for long-term care then?
Representative Fisher, Madam Chair. Yes, it is.
Okay.
Okay. Very good. Okay.
The next couple
please
slides.
Please continue.
The Navigator and Model of Care pilots. The fact that we needed this different system was really recognized by the counties a number of years ago. What was referred to as Navigator pilots were started, and I believe we're going to hear something about the success of those Navigator pilots. So they've been in existence for a few years, have had some good results. Last session, we brought forward one of two things. Either we're going to talk about bringing forward these Navigator pilots in the old system of of payment and how we're conceptualizing, or would we kind of bring forward the model of care report that was a legislative report that came forward last year, talked about moving the system and taking into account healthcare reform and the other parts that are taking place in a broader context, if you will. Those pilots were authorized, a new model of care. The counties are just in process of being selected to move forward. So this year, what we're looking at happening is in a pilot in the north, in the metro, and in the south, experimenting, if you will, with new service models. Care coordination, peer recovery support, direct access for assessment, telemedicine. These were all in the report as to new service models, and we're looking at how does that work in Minnesota. And I was saying experimenting. I talked a little bit about how we've gotten kind of behind in Minnesota. We're the leader in lots of areas, but this is not one of them. Mm-hmm. Nationally, many states have already amended their state plans to include these chronic care services. We in Minnesota, because we were so successful with our consolidated fund and the way we've done things, have really stayed with those systems. So what we're looking at in these pilots is not inventing something new, but really taking a look at what are the learnings nationally, testing them out, testing them with Minnesota communities and laws, and kind of say, okay, what should we be changing in our system that's really a good fit for us? So that's really what these pilots are about. So they're underway, and they should start. The pilots are just in process. They should be selected and underway. And we're approaching them very much from a learning collaborative standpoint, so that they're not closed pilots, if you will, but any county managed care plans to participate, and let's really flesh out what these new services are. This next slide was actually part of last summer there was a policy academy, and with a number of legislators and some of us from DHS, and one of the assignments that came forward from that was to a very high level rough timeline for what would it take to actually move our system from this acute model to this chronic model. Because here's the challenge. We've got a busload of people that need services ongoing, and how do you change the tire while you're en route? You can't just move on a dime a system that we've built over many, many years. You really need to stage it appropriately in terms of creating new services that are then up and running before you start taking away or morphing other services, I think is really the concept. And this timeline roughly lays out a few steps. And the first one is kind of this first phase that we're in of really identifying what new services that we need in the state that would make sense for us. And then to engage in some of these other conversations around what about the recovery supports? I talked about let's get into healthcare. What's healthcare? That's really what this first phase is about. Next phase is let's talk about recovery supports. We know that we need, let's say, housing supports or vocational supports or whatever other conversations we might want to have around recovery supports, that we need to have those conversations. But we can't have any ending of services until we have adequate services designed and at least in process of being in place.
And Mr. Hartford, I think my eyes have gotten worse over the interim here, but some of these are really pretty small. So where would we be able to find this in a larger print copy? Because even up there and on our sheets, it's really hard to read.
I would have to send them, I will have them sent in a larger form.
Maybe you could do that and we could distribute that to members. So I think this is pretty important. Thanks.
So what are our implications for services? We need to provide easy access and transition between different levels of care. We need to add addiction medications as clinically appropriate, developing recovery supports, continuing care and the use of technology supports. And again, all of those are just implications for these new services. A couple of big takeaways. Addiction is a health problem, and I've kind of challenged my staff and myself to take a look at what would it look like if we didn't talk about behavior health or substance abuse as something different than healthcare. It's hard to even wrap our minds around it if we actually treated it as any other chronic disease. And I think that's where a vision or a goal of where we need to get to down the line. And again, what does it mean to have a chronic, not acute condition? Purchasers need to change contracts, funding mechanisms, and expectations. Providers need to change from an acute to a chronic care support design and service delivery system. Our service delivery system has not conceptualized what does it mean to actually support people with substance abuse over the long haul, expecting relapse. What would be the response besides going back to an acute outpatient or an acute episode of care? So again, here we have a new equation. New science, technology, new recovery movement, new tools, new funding gives us a new Minnesota recovery model that we have not done in the past. And with that, if there's no other questions,
we do have questions. Yes. Okay, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate your informing us about all of this. It's very interesting. It makes sense to me, and I'm sorry if I missed this, but is there, just in terms of dollars, I do a lot of prevention work. A lot of my background is in prevention and early intervention in several areas. I'm assuming that we have some data to show the savings on investment, the return on investment for changing this model to going to the acute care model rather than the crisis management sort of thing that we've been doing in the past. So is there good data to show that this is economically beneficial? We know logically that it's going to help people, but do we have numbers on job retention and things like that when people are treated as a chronic illness instead of crisis?
Mr. Representative Ford, Madam Chair, there's national data on return on investment. We do not have robust state data in that direction. Likewise, there is also data around prevention efforts also that I did not include very much in this presentation. I will talk about that more because, again, that's a significant part of how do we do a better job in the long haul of improving, decreasing expenditure on substance abuse. If we decrease addiction as a whole, is really the long-term return on investment.
A follow-up?
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm assuming that part of this work that you're doing includes data collection so that we will have some good reports on the information, the statistics that you're creating.
Representative Ward, Madam Chair, yes, that is the plan, is to, again, move to being a much more outcome-driven system of care, if you will, like the rest of healthcare. I'm kind of back to that same theme. Like healthcare, what are the outcomes we're expecting to get and start to get good measurements around that? Because we haven't historically done that.
Thank you.
Okay. This is a good conversation. We have Representatives Abler, Fisher, and Newton. So, Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, Mr. Hunter. Welcome back, and I'm glad you're working on this, and I'm glad you're kind of wrapping it into a focused, outcome-driven thing. I think Representative Loeffler's question was, what's the essential benefit set? And now, I'm not sure if I've even seen all of that, so that's what she was after, I think. I don't know if you know that offhand. Then I have that's not my real question. Do you know that offhand, what's in the package?
I don't. Yeah. I could certainly get that, what was established as the core benefit set.
I think that's really one of the questions. But my big question is, what's the role of DHS with a veteran who's got a real bad substance problem, and I'm going somewhere with this, but is there any focus on that group That's my first question.
Mr. Hartford.
Representative Abler. Yes, we're doing some efforts around the veteran population in particular, but as far as access to care, there wouldn't be a separate consideration. I mean, whatever services are available would be available to a veteran. We're also currently establishing a veterans advisory council for behavioral health in partnership with some community agencies, recognizing there are some specific issues for veterans in the state and looking at developing some specific resources for them in addition to the current delivery system.
Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, and I'll be specific, I guess. I didn't know about the housing meetings. I would have come to that, but I ran into the same woman, this Melanie. There's a place called Eagle's Healing Nest in Sauk Center. They're actually renting an old DHS site from the guy who bought it from DHS. And there's 40 vets. It's all private. And this woman, Melanie, who's the daughter of a veteran from, I think, Vietnam, who committed suicide. His whole platoon, either the dead or they committed suicide, which is tragic. And like, so I was on my travels, and this guy said, "You got to stop and see this place." I went out, and I was just overwhelmed. I only had a half hour to be there, but it was like amazing. And she testified, and there is a huge gap, and so the VA, the end of the line, the substance abuse veterans who are really work comp clients of ours. We help them. They're on our dime. They're our responsibility. Right. Between the VA and DHS and whoever, there's a huge gap. And no one knows what to do with them. And this Melanie has, on her own, they got a $15,000 a month operation serving 40 people. And they feed them. And the veterans sit up with each other at night and help them through the nights. And they have people from, I think, Korea all the way to some of the desert wars that are there, some 20-year-olds even I met. And it seems like there's got to be a way to address that with, and the counties aren't cooperating with this thing. I'm like, really? And it seems like at least they should get GRH to give some basic, in our current structure. And I've been talking to the commissioner, and I'm talking to you now, and I put a call to the governor. He hasn't got back to me yet. But this is something that we just really need to look after. This particular group could be a model for how to do it using some private stuff, but from the core of the stuff that we've already set up, without having to have new programs. And I'll talk to you more about it after. I'm not doing this to embarrass you. I'm just doing it to call attention to it, because I was just, Jerry was at the hearing. It was just overwhelming, the story. And so the VA, these people come, the VA says, she said, well, they had nowhere to go, so I went and picked them up at the VA. So here's this person who's got a bad chemical substance abuse problem, your very topic here. And there's nowhere to take them. And so they call her, and she takes them. The counties have no resources or interest or capacity or whatever. And the VA has this, they have study groups and working on things and spending big money on the administrative side and not on the focusing on these clients, which are our sons and daughters. And there's got to be a way. And so I brought up today just to call attention to it to get. I'll talk to you later, and I'm
well. Let's see if
Jerry.
Mr. Hartford has any comment.
Thanks.
Anything you want to say about that?
Just that I'm familiar. I know our director Kevin Evenson is looking into the topic that you brought forward, and I'd be glad to be in with you concerning what he finds out and kind of see what we can do about that situation that I'm not familiar with, but will be.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, it's just such an interesting. This is a
many facets.
I don't mean to get overly passionate. It just stunned me when I wandered in there. So thanks.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I have is, I know that when you first started off your presentation, Commissioner Hartford, that you were mentioning about everything as behavioral health, and then focused on the chemical dependency portion of it. And what I'm wondering is, what is the model? What are things being looked at in that for those that have got dual diagnosis? I mean, it's not uncommon that people have chemical dependency issues and have mental health. How is that going to be addressed, or how is that going to be tied in? Would that be also incorporated in through here? And the reason I'm asked, because I see the emphasis, the chemical dependency, but also recognizing there's this other component that gets tied in sometimes. How would that be addressed going forward?
Mr. Hartford.
Representative Fisher, Madam Chair. I think that's a good point, because the fact is individuals come not in the in the categories that we design, but they come with the conditions that they have. And we know that individuals have with mental illness, have substance use dependent or abuse anyway at the rates of 60-70%, and likewise individuals with substance abuse have mental health diagnoses. So as we move to this system of having more comprehensive healthcare assessments, where the screenings, diagnosis, and assessment are more comprehensive in nature, we should be able to develop treatment plans from those assessments that are more comprehensive and really take the whole person into account, as opposed to what we're doing today is clearly substance abuse. Well, that means you're going down a particular track, and that we divide them out in our programs and our thinking, as opposed to like any other healthcare condition, you're seen as an individual with an individual package of co-occurring conditions.
Representative Fisher, anything further?
I guess what it brings to mind a little bit is, you know, so often we get siloed, it seems, between mental health component and chemical dependency. And I think, you know, this is a perfect example where I think at times we have to start thinking of a little differently about blending them together. And I think it goes back to what Commissioner Hartford is saying, is we need to take a look at the whole health component. And we somehow have to start thinking, instead of silos like we have right now, is treating it as where you go to a primary care person, and if you go to, you know, if you had cancer, you might be referred to an appropriate doctor that was taking care of the appropriate cancer you have. We should be thinking about the same thing as we're looking at the mental health and the chemical dependency, is working more through that. And I think these are potentially some areas where you could see some eventual savings to the whole healthcare system, is thinking of more globally that way. And I think somehow, and I don't know how to do that, but I think these are the discussions that we need to start having to start moving us in that direction. And I think that's where the whole health Affordable Care Act is, seems to be moving us into that field where we get better overall health care, which makes us as a society much better.
Okay. We've got Representative Newton and then Representative Hillary. Representative Newton.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a follow-up on Jim Abler's comment in a way. On your slide 14, you have eight agencies there dealing with state substance abuse strategy, but I don't see the MDVA on there, the Department of Veterans Affairs. And I don't know if there's a reason for that, but in addition to places like the Eagle's Nest and the places that are served by Kathleen Vitalis and MACV, we have veterans homes in Minnesota, state-operated, specifically I'm thinking of the home at Hastings and the one in Minneapolis, where we have veterans suffering from chemical dependency. And so when I hear you say, you talk about healthcare, put into healthcare, clearly what belongs, you know, what is healthcare dollars. Are we doing that when it comes to the veterans facilities, to the MDVA, or are we leaving that up to the Veterans Administration and the state MDVA to take care of that?
Mr. Hartford.
Representative, Madam Chair, if I'm not mistaken, they are participating. They're not technically a state agency, so they are not a part of this grouping, but they are participating. That we do have, if I'm not mistaken, let me just kind of add. Excuse me, it's the National Guard that's at the table.
Okay, I would encourage you to consider at least, excuse me, Madam Chair,
Representative Newton,
to have MDVA involved, because they're really into the healthcare business in terms of helping the veterans. But I'm just, you know, there's always that area between what is healthcare service, DHL services, and what is veteran services. And in some ways, in this committee I'm chairing right now, it seems like anything that's supported by the federal VA in any way is sort of left to deal with by themselves, and they're not in the state healthcare system as much. So I just want to make that as a comment, and perhaps talk to you later about this.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative. We'll look into that.
Thank you, Mr. Hartford. Yeah, another silo to be broken down, right? And absolutely. I mean, a Minnesota veteran who's a veteran is also a Minnesota citizen, and how do we make sure that we, again, get the right services to the people at the time they need them and give them the follow-up they need?
Madam Chair, if I may, this also goes back to your comments about the dual diagnosis, where so many of our veterans that are suffering from chemical and alcohol dependency are also PTSD patients. So, you know, it's just not dealing with a simple issue, supposedly simple issue. It's much more complicated than that when it comes to some of our veterans.
Thank you. Representative Mullery.
Oh, thank you, ma'am. First of all, with regard to Representative Fisher's point about the mental health, I've got a committee working on that over the summer on juvenile justice, so at least it's going there, forcing them to work together on this. But my question to you is, and basically, I don't know enough about the treat specifics, so you can kind of snow me or not, and it's a difficult position for you, but about 3 years ago, I was at a national conference on public safety, and they were, when they heard, there was only maybe 15 of us, when the speaker heard us from Minnesota, he says, well, you've got a lot to be proud of. You were decades ahead of us on treatment of chemical dependency. The problem is that you're about two decades behind us now on, not on finances, but on the actual way of treatment. Are you talking about now we are going to be catching up with what the leading states are doing on the method of treatment? Is that what you're saying, or is it that it's more on
Mullery,
the fiscal model?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. And I do have a final question, or if I don't have any other members on the list, but I want to, Mr. Hartford, I want to sort of ask the devil's advocate question that I know will be on the minds of a lot of Minnesotans as we talk about moving to a chronic disease model, which, you know, and I want to say, just for any angry Minnesotans who might contact me after I say this, I agree that it's a chronic disease and that we ought to look at it as such. But I think a lot of people might ask, though, if it's a chronic disease and we should behave and feel toward people who have it just like we do with other chronic diseases, what about the personal responsibility element? In other words, you know, people who have chronic diseases often cause a lot of destruction in their own lives, or pardon me, let me restate that. People who have addiction problems, chemical dependency problems, often cause a lot of chaos in their own lives and in the lives of other people. And so we have sort of this tension in society. Should we be mad at them, or should we feel sorry for them, I guess, to put it in a sort of a very... you know, to really draw it out. So I want you to kind of address that. What would you say to people who would say, what do you mean it's a chronic disease? You know, this person broke into my house, or, you know, he chooses to keep drinking, or, you know, those kinds of issues. And I think everybody knows what I'm talking about, because, you know, it's hard to feel sorry for people and say, oh, you just have a disease, when people are causing a lot of trouble, a lot of expense, you know, breakup of families, and other things that in the extreme, to the extreme, that we all know chemical dependency can cause. So I'd like you to just kind of address that head on as we're talking about moving into a chronic disease model.
Madam Chair, I'm trying to address the aspect from a chronic care, from a health care delivery standpoint, which is, if I were to say, I have diabetes, if I don't take my medication one more time, is my healthcare system going to tell me, you've had enough tries at this, we're not going to treat you anymore for your diabetes? Or I had a stent put in and I'm not controlling, I haven't reduced my amount of saturated fat that I'm eating, does that mean that I'm not going to get treatment anymore from my cardiologist? I think that's the point with this, is we've actually done that with people with substance abuse. If you take a look at the decision-making taking place, people have had two treatments, they've had this, they've had that. You don't get services anymore, and that's not appropriate because this is a chronic disease. The other element about, not to say that people oftentimes with substance abuse dependence create havoc in their own lives and in the lives of their families, and break laws, let's say. Those are all issues that need to be addressed as we address those issues. You know, I guess we get to choose if we're going to feel how we feel about other people. But I think the fact that this is a disease and people have their brain has been hijacked, and they're acting out of craving and drive, because that's ultimately what it is. It's a drive to get high and to use substances, and it costs them consequences. But it should not interfere with our healthcare delivery system saying, yes, in fact, because you're relapsing, because you're doing what we would predict that you do with a chronic disease and in substance abuse is to use the, is to use substance, we would not restrict services for somebody.
So as I'm kind of understanding you, so you're not saying that we should excuse people's behavior when they're, even though their behavior may in fact be driven by chemical dependency, but you're talking about on the other side, once we look at how to treat people, we have to change our thinking about what treatment means. And
yes, ma'am.
But the personal responsibility element, I think, is also always going to be there, right? Mm-hmm. Because treatment, just as treatment for diabetes involves perhaps changing your diet, taking your medication, getting more exercise, or whatever it is you have to do, mm-hmm. there's a personal responsibility element there as well, even though you didn't bring on the disease yourself.
Yep.
Correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Anything else from members? Okay, and thank you then for your presentation. And you had someone else that you wanted to say a few words?
I asked Carrie Zarbach, who was actually a member of our model of care work group. She's also a member of the Council of Health Plans Behavioral Health Group. She's the current director of Quality Improvement and Community Initiatives for Medica Behavioral Health.
Okay, well, why don't we invite her to the podium?
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And we'll need you to say your name again and just spell it for us, please, so we can get it on the minutes.
Sure. My name is Carrie Zarbach. Carrie is C-A-R-Y. Zarbach is Z as in zebra, A-H-R-B-O-C-K.
Okay. It's Zarbach, so welcome, and go ahead. And
thank you. I just want to say what an honor it was to be a part of the continuum of care planning process, and that what I found one of the strengths in Minnesota that we have a bunch of things to be proud of, but I think the collaborative process that occurs within our state with the Department of Human Services, with the health plans that are in the state, with the counties, with the consumer advocates and the providers, really enables us to work together to improve healthcare delivery systems. It's not perfect yet. We've got a lot of action that we need to keep working on, but that collaboration really has made it possible for us to develop different innovative solutions and take the approaches so that we can have an improved healthcare delivery system. So I really am pleased, and I also appreciate the opportunity to come talk with you about this planning process. Our view, certainly within Medica Behavioral Health, is that substance use disorders is a health condition that should be treated and that at times requires immediate but consistently requires ongoing access to healthcare services. And so that something that's happened on the commercial product side is that people do have direct access to treatment. So as Assistant Commissioner Hartford said, that for people within the to access funds through the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund, they need to go to a county employee or their designee to have an assessment that includes a financial eligibility as well as a diagnostic assessment process to access that health care. People who have had private insurance can go directly to a service provider, get the assessment, find out what's going on for them, and then actually move directly into treatment based on that assessment, which is what all of us also have the opportunity. If we have a health condition, you go to your doctor, they say, oh yeah, you've got an ear infection, let me treat that. Or you've got this kind of condition, let's get going treating that. And so we are pleased to be with that component of this model of care process to be able to have that direct access for people suffering from substance use disorders to have access to that assessment and go on to treatment. It's also so important to have that individualized treatment process. Some of our, that Minnesota model was kind of the here's what you need if you have this kind of, if you have chemical dependency, here's this treatment that you need. And that hasn't always been tailored to the individual's needs. And what, as representatives have acknowledged here, is that often there are mental health conditions that contribute to the chemical dependency. There are also physical health conditions that either can contribute to or are exacerbated by a substance use disorder. And so to be able to have that individualized treatment that really does incorporate potentially individualized substance use treatment concurrent with mental health treatment. We know that depression is concurrent or co-occurs with chemical dependency about 60% of the time, and often depression really does make it difficult for people to make change. That's part of the symptoms of depression or anxiety. So we want those conditions treated at the same time so that it's easier for people to benefit from the treatment. So I think this model also can support that, and certainly we've been working toward that on the commercial products, and I think also through the integrated dual diagnosis treatment approach that the Department of Human Services has been working on to really provide people with both of those, that expertise in mental health and substance use disorders, to be able to provide that treatment at the same time. We also have been looking at, for those people whose psychosocial situation or co-occurring disorders, really it's such a more complex condition. They often really need ongoing support after they're done with that primary treatment to coordinate all those different issues that are happening in their life, to be able, again, to take advantage and implement the treatment that they have received, to implement and make that treatment effective and efficient. So within Medica Behavioral Health, we've had some care coordination pilots occurring with some of our treatment providers, one in a more rural area, one in a more metro area, really looking at what are the benefits that can happen, have that ongoing contact and communication with people after they're done with what has traditionally been called primary treatment, and help them if they need, have concerns. We know that relapse is a part of the course of this illness. To be able to get in at a less intensive level of treatment, so to the point that was made earlier, maybe you don't have to wait until it goes back to rehospitalization, that you can actually treat the condition as one might, again, if you have a physical condition that is starting to deteriorate, to catch it at that point rather than waiting until it's so serious that you need to be hospitalized again. So we are pleased and hope to be a part of the planning for these and implementation of the pilot products or pilot projects that are being implemented. We think that certainly for our Minnesota healthcare programs, plans that would be impacted by the pilot, we also might be able to incorporate some of those plans and have those available to commercial members who meet those same criteria. So we're excited again about the collaboration that is possible, and that we have such a strong history within Minnesota for those. So those are my comments. Thank you again for the opportunity.
Thank you.
For the opportunity.
Thank you. Questions? Questions for members? Yeah, Representative.
Madam Chair, you said you were with Medica, correct?
Correct.
So, you know what? With some of the changes in the Affordable Care Act, and when we talked about county funds and money that gets out, so the idea is that more people would be onto the private health care market. How do you see that impacting what happens in particular with that? So, meaning, how do those funds that were designated toward, you know, county services, now that their shift would potentially be shifted into the private market, how is it that basically what's the impact and how does that look, and are the services that the plans that you put together at Medica, how do they compare to what some of these folks were on that we're getting services directly from the government.
Madam Chair, one of the things that I am very excited about, honestly, is for people who have had access to chemically potency treatment through the Consolidated Fund, that was all they had access to. They didn't have access to mental health services under that or other health care services. They only had that treatment. So when people are having access to the full array of health care services, that it will be allow them to be able to access those other services that impact their co-occurring, as well as the Consolidated Fund through the planning process that we've been able to do can help support some of those non-healthcare services that aren't necessarily available to people, so that full continuum meeting those individualized needs will be, I expect, to be more available for people.
Representative Scholl?
Madam Chair, how do you see our health insurance providers being receptive, and what do you think their investment would be into this particular model? Because I would see that if we're shifting back towards Medica being more responsible when it's on, when you're on the, your health plan, it would seem profitable in the long term for you to keep them out of these chronic issues into a long-term stability. And so how are you with the other health plans, how do you feel the buy-in is? How are you, what's the reception to it?
Ms. Starbuck, and could I ask you just pull the mic a little bit closer? There we go. I'm not sure we're picking you up all the way.
Okay. So I think that you're right that we are excited and think that it is important for people to have access to chemically potency treatment services. Also in terms of, as I talked about before, that direct access. So get in, get the assessment, and get going on the treatment right away. What can happen with this condition is that if there's a delay between the assessment and actually start of treatment, that can be a barrier to access to treatment. So all of the health plans actually monitor our access and have expectations and set those. We also are concerned in terms of treating the whole person, and certainly there have been discussions at the Behavioral Health Subcommittee and in a presentation that all the health plans did to the continuum of care planning, that we support that longitudinal approach to treatment and that chronic condition treatment versus just that acute episode. So there is support within the health plans for that model as well.
Okay. Thank you very much, and thank you for your testimony. I'm sorry. We have one more question.
Just an announcement, yeah. Maybe. I have a brochure about this place. I had some copies made so members can just read about it, maybe make their own contact for this Eagles Healing Nest place.
Sure, we can send those around.
Yeah, so
sure.
The page.
While we're maybe while we're
just
changing.
To warn people.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much. And
thank you.
We're going to hear from Paul Fleissner and Heather Geertz from the counties, and you could both come up. And while we're changing the stage here, I just I neglected to introduce Owen Wirth, who's our new committee LA, and of course sitting next to me here, so you'll get used to seeing Owen through this next session, I hope. And then Lynn Sando is very graciously also helping us today as our page, so thank you to both of them. So this is Owen's maiden voyage, so to speak, as our committee legislative assistant. So welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. Paul Fleissner, Director of Community Services for Olmsted County. And I'm here with, you want to introduce me?
Hello, Madam Chair and committee. I'm Heather Geertz. I'm the Clinical Director at Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center in Rochester, Minnesota.
I invited Heather here today because she is the key leader involved in our regional CD pilot project, so she can put a face to the people we've served in that project. I just want to say I'm excited and encouraged by what I just heard from DHS and what I've been hearing in building a new system, because we've been stuck with an old model that works for some, but an awful lot of folks it hasn't worked over time. And so we've been searching for alternatives for a long time. That's why we proposed and implemented a CD pilot in the past. And as I look at our service system, and it's important for you to know that Homestead County Community Services includes probation services, veteran services, public assistance, and social services. So we see it across the spectrum. I can tell you, just to add some faces to the issue, the other day we had to commit an 85-year-old for chemical dependency issues. You want to talk about chronic? I've never seen anybody that old, but they were literally killing themselves with alcohol. And they're right now sitting in a holdover program in Zumbro Valley Mental Health Center waiting for treatment because there are waiting lists for treatment. So when you talk about access, that's a real story. On the very other end of the spectrum, we are seeing tremendous amounts of chemical abuse related to child protection. I talked to a dad the other day that we terminated the rights of their child and did a closed adoption. So that dad is never going to see his child again. Now, he tried to go through treatment. He couldn't. The mother had passed away at an early age. So this three-year-old was removed and is going to an adoptive home, as they should. But it tells you about the costs from many different ways of this kind of problem. So I hope to talk to you a little bit about what counties do. I would say the integration that we heard about from Mr. Hartford is really exciting news from my perspective, because I think treating CD in isolation with our old model is not working, and it's expensive, and none of us can afford that. The county role right now, as maybe you already know, so I'll kind of go through this quickly, is we have to do a financial and a chemical dependency assessment. And then we authorize placements through agreements with providers. It's an entitlement program, so if they qualify, we send them. The problem is, do we have anywhere to send them? The other issue I would say is we talk about the consolidated fund, and we see that 50 to 60% do real well in traditional treatment. That's a big percentage that isn't doing well. And when you think about the four services that we've had and been able to offer people for a long time, you know, inpatient, outpatient, extended care, halfway house, and I guess medication assistance, it's really limiting, and that's one of the reasons we got on the pilot, and we'll talk about that later. So we coordinate placements. We also have commitments, as I just mentioned. We pay for those commitments. And then integrating services. It's really important that we don't just do chemical dependency services. We have an array of services at the county, and it's our responsibility to connect the dots. I heard some things about veteran services. I think that's a critical piece. One of the things that we did is we co-located our veteran services right next to behavioral health. There's a very seamless handoff in our county that our senior veteran service officer, Neil Doyle, if he was here today, would tell you that we have a great working relationship, and those veterans get quick access to services when they need it, and that's important. Another part of the county role is funding. There's a mix of state, county, and federal funding in the consolidated fund. The county match now is between 23 and 24%. But for things like detox, we pay 100% for youth and adults. And I'll tell you a little bit about detox. Later, I'm going to talk about our CD pilot, some of our other housing strategies and things we've done. Our county was on a trajectory to hit $1 million for detox. That's on a $62 million human services budget. That's a big chunk. So we engage in these alternative strategies of working with folks, not just because we believe in the services, but there's a financial reason. And because of that, things like the CD pilot, some supportive housing, we turn the curve. We always talk about bending the curve of the costs that we're spending. We were, as I said, heading towards $1 million. The last 3 years, we've been at about $880,000 for that service, and actually this year we're going to come $50,000 under. That's because we've started to bend that curve, and it's because we've got some early intervention kinds of things going on. This is just a quick budget from our county's perspective. Not, I don't know if it's helpful to you, but for holdovers, for things like those commitments I mentioned, we spend $55,000, or we anticipate that in 14. Detox, you see the number there. RCD pilot, there's our cost there. A consolidated fund, $400,000. Then we do some things like an abuse, some outreach to reach hard-to-reach populations like the Somali population. We do some assessment work. and then the staff that are involved in those various pieces. And we have some staff located in places like our adult detention center because there's so much work to do in that setting. System challenges, and this speaks to why I'm excited about the work of DHS. We just don't have any integration with healthcare and other systems right now. We don't have parity with CD and other services. And so folks go without access. They don't have connections to the healthcare system. And because of it, I know of clients we've sent dozens of times to treatment because it's an entitlement. If they need it, we have to send them, but we don't have other alternatives. And I'm glad we're moving in a different direction. Challenges with access. Like I said, there are waiting lists for some of these services when it comes to inpatient, some of those things. Housing. You can't get somebody sober if they're not housed. That's the bottom line. We need housing with supports. And I'll show you a program that has worked for us. I mentioned our child protection system. And we just did a study on youth and family homelessness in our community, and it's growing rapidly. And of course, a lot of that is tied also to alcohol and drugs. We're very excited about MA funding CD services, so people do have better access. Over time, the consolidated fund has been reduced. We used to have different tiers. Actually, Tier 2, which used to be sort of the working poor, we had probably the best success with because they had even more at risk when they didn't stay sober. And we dropped that down to just Tier 1 folks. So more folks will have access, and I think we'll get ahead of the problem rather than always responding to the deep end.
Mr. Fleissner, could you just give us what the tiers are that you're talking about
well,
here?
We used to have Tier 1 and Tier 2. They were different levels of income, and I don't remember what they were, but now we pretty much, in the consolidated fund, just fund folks who are really, really poor, pretty much not working. Parity and healthcare expansion has been mentioned. I want to get to some of the newer things that we've done. As we look at some things like supportive housing, and you get people housed and their basic needs met, they're actually more likely to be successful in treatment in our experience. There are medications out there. I believe in your packet there may be an article. One of the things that we haven't done well over time, there are drugs that help people stay sober that we don't really use in our system very much. Part of that is we haven't integrated with primary care and taught physicians to use some of these drugs. When I look at things like tobacco, we use various drugs to help people stay off it. There's great research around several drugs that also work that we don't use. That's an opportunity. As I mentioned, traditional treatment works for 50 to 60%. That's great, but let's find ways to serve those others. And one of the ways, and you'll hear about the CD pilot, is intensive case management has worked for us. It's worked to help employment. It's worked to help people stay sober. It's worked in a variety of ways for people. One of the things we've done, as was mentioned before, do people really want to come to the county to get an assessment, to get access to a healthcare system? Well, that's the way they have to do it now. I agree that integrating those assessments into the healthcare system and the provider system works. In fact, we've farmed ours out to the providers, so there's not that extra step. Promising practices. Well, I'm going to turn it over briefly to Heather to talk about our CD pilot project, and then I'll talk to you a little bit about other stuff that we're thinking about.
Thank you, Madam. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Paul. Right. So just to give you a brief kind of understanding, sometimes it's really a lot easier to hear about a person. And some of you may have heard about this person when I had done some testifying earlier during the legislative session, but we're continuing with success, and we're even closer to a big milestone for a person that I'm going to call Jane. And Jane was one of our first clients. She joined the program about 3 years ago now. She was found underneath a bridge in zero-degree weather. She was homeless and on a CD commitment. She entered into inpatient treatment, which is when our program became involved with her. We were able to work with her to transition into a halfway house, then into sober, a sober board and lodge or sober living environment, and then finally able to help her transition into her own apartment where she still resides. She was able to reunite with her daughter, which she hadn't had contact with in several years due to her chronic chemical dependency use. Now they have daily phone contact, and they even have been having weekly face-to-face and have a very strong relationship. She is also going back to school. She is extremely close, probably 2 to 3 months away from getting her GED, and is starting to complete college applications to, her goal is to go back to school and enter the human service field, maybe work in a detox or something similar to help people that are experiencing the same problems or the same concerns that she felt that she has kind of dealt with throughout her life. She is now working on 35 months of sobriety, so we're very excited to help support her through that. So that's one case, and I think it speaks to a lot of the different issues and a lot of the different things that the Navigator is able to do. As Paul had indicated, we the traditional treatment works for a lot of people, but in this sub-cohort of people who have struggled with chemical dependency their whole life and they have the chronic chemical dependency diagnosis, it doesn't always work with the traditional model. And what we have found is by the intensive case management, going in there, helping these individuals first get housed, then we can help them get connected with a primary care physician, a psychiatrist, a therapist, maybe help them get on health insurance, which they never were able to actually follow through with in the past. We're able to put that continuum of care in place so that they are able to use the supports that are available to them and actually make a difference in their life. A couple kind of data pieces that I think are really, really interesting to look at. One is, as you heard Paul talk about the detox costs in Olmsted County, one thing that we have seen is that in the 2 years prior to admission into the pilot project, individuals had 221 detox admission. Now, this is based off of a group, a sample size of 80 people. 221 detox admissions in the 2 years prior. In the time that they were in the project, and the average length of time is 13.34 months, they have had 99 admissions. And to even go more with that, 24 of those were from one person. So it's an outlier. I mean, that's a data outlier. And more importantly, I think, is that 67% of the people have not accessed detox once since entering the program. And so we're really, you know, when you talk about cost, in Rochester for Olmsted County, a detox day is $321, I think, or $326 a day. So if you look at that decrease in days, you're talking of a savings of around $80,000 right there. Additionally, with that, what we have seen is with treatment and the recidivism of treatment costs. And when we talk about treatment, what we're talking about is either in our traditional models, inpatient, outpatient, and halfway house. And in the 2 years prior, again for this sample of 80, the 2 years prior to admission into the program, there were 291 treatment admissions. Then, after being in the program, there were only 46 treatment episodes once they've entered the program. And again, looking at the number of people who haven't accessed it, that was 69%. So almost 70% of individuals did not need to access that treatment and are still having those really solid results. We've talked about housing and employment, and we have some, you know, data around that also, and just looking at 56% of the clients were homeless prior to entering to the program. all but one have been housed since they've entered the program. And the one person that hasn't been housed, there are options available. That person is making a decision as an adult that they don't want any of the options that are available. So that's a personal choice for no housing there. And then prior to the involvement in the pilot, four people were only actively employed. But since they have entered this project, 69% are either actively employed, enrolled in a school, or doing some sort of volunteering opportunity, which also allows them to really feel more productive and able to give back. And so that's really, really exciting to see. So those are just some, you know, I've got a lot of other numbers, and I could probably sit here and talk for a long time, but in essence of the time, and respect for that, those are, I think, the main highlights that we have found, at least in our Southeast Minnesota pilot project.
And just to add to what Heather said, what we did with that pilot is we didn't ask for new money. We just asked freedom and flexibility of using our own dollars differently. So it wasn't new dollars invested. It was repurposing them and getting better outcomes, both financially and programmatically. Some of the opportunity gaps, I've mentioned some of these. A lot of it relates to how we do things like intensive case management, care coordination across our system. I think I was encouraged by the testifier from Medica. As they look at this as a holistic problem within health plans, I think we have an opportunity to have better results. I mentioned as I started that there are not enough beds available, so that 85-year-old person in on a hold right now is waiting for a placement. So our system is jammed up. So one of the suggestions might be perhaps health plans can buy or develop more beds so we have quicker access. This is a lot of data. I don't know if I want to tell you all the data from the Region 10 pilot. So one of the ones I want to show you, here's the detox costs we mentioned going down. And here's the employment one. This blew my socks off because these folks are not easy to employ. They've got some track records that make it hard. And when we started this pilot, we had 5% of them employed. And last number I had seen, which is not as new a data as Heather's, was 65% were employed. We also did supportive housing for chronic inebriates. That's another thing that turned the curve for us. Those folks, we've decreased their use of detox by 88% since we housed them. A CRAF program, and I sent a sheet around related to this program. It's our fetal alcohol syndrome prevention program through a small nonprofit that work with moms that are alcoholics or other drug users, and over the years they've been in place for probably 12-14 years. They prevent positive tox screens from happening so that kids are not exposed to alcohol when they're in the womb and don't end up with fetal alcohol syndrome. And if you look at that sheet, there's a return on investment related to that. There's lots of studies. If you look at that sheet that came around, you'll see a mother who adopted a child with fetal alcohol syndrome and what the list of services that child needs. Those all come out of the pockets you're trying to fund. And when you think of the dozens of kids we've prevented over the years, that's a huge investment that is in the right direction. And I appreciate the fact that the legislature funded this program last year. And to me, one of the best things you could do is expand it more across the state, but that's for you to decide, not me.
And Mr. Fleissner, could I back you up for just a second? You've
sure.
got this, the slide Madam that's Chair. The 16, and that, and I just want to really highlight what that is. You went by that one pretty quickly, and I'm not sure everybody
okay.
understands that.
Okay.
So,
what we did is we looked at our top. Originally, we looked at our top, I think, 60 users of detox and how much they were spending. And we partnered with Center City Housing, who has developed three of these programs in the state, one in Duluth, one in St. Cloud, and now one in Rochester. They got amazing results out of these folks by getting them housed. And even though it's not a sober facility, they work on reducing their use of alcohol and eventually trying to get them into treatment. But they also get them into primary care. I think 98% of these folks now have a primary care physician. These were the folks living under our bridges and those kinds of things. And we did a study of their use of health care, their use of emergency rooms, use of law enforcement, and we're revisiting that study now, but I can tell you all of those things are down. They used to get their health care through the emergency room. They were, uncompensated care for a hospital. Now all those things are in place, and we're seeing amazing results. It's not surprising because they'd already documented these results in Duluth and St. Cloud. I can tell you one of the nicest calls I ever got was from a family member of one of the folks who died in there, saying, I can't tell you how much it meant to us that my dad actually was living somewhere when he passed away, that he wasn't under a bridge. So it's a respect issue as well as a financial issue and a program issue. Housing with supports work.
Right, and I just wanted to comment too, Mr. Fleissner, that just a flag for members, that this is a controversial program. And a lot of people will say, why should we house these people? These are drunks, why should they get free housing? I don't get free housing, and that kind of thing. And I think what we're seeing here is some real results that show actual savings besides the humanitarian aspect of it, actual savings of public dollars as a result of this, thereby, again, kind of showing that CD treatment is not a one-size-all proposition, that you have to start people at different points sometimes.
Yep, there's an array that's needed. Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, at a 10th one, as we wrap up, some of the recommendations I would suggest as you look forward, one of them is integration with the healthcare system. I think DHS is on the right path. I think one of the controversies you may hear from counties is letting loose in terms of whether we're doing the assessment if we're also having to pay. And that's where you will get into some controversies over time. But I think the integration is better for our clients and better long-term for what we do. As I said, for some of these folks on the deep end of the system, intensive case management works. Let's find, I'm excited that the other couple counties are engaging in a different kind of pilot. Their pilot isn't mirroring ours, it's mirroring what the state's headed toward. And I think those learnings will be critical. I think investment in supportive housing makes a lot of sense. Better access to data from DHS. One of our challenges in the pilot and in general is getting data to measure our own success. We are having to set up duplicate kinds of measuring systems. Parity's been mentioned a lot. We would agree with that. And obtaining more data from the healthcare system, because we also don't get data out of the healthcare system to help us on the social services side understand what's going on. And with analytics these days, we see them being used in law enforcement and other places. We have some powerful tools out there that we're not using. Let's get on that. I would also, and one of the things not on the list here, is our world is changing with these things. The Pew Institute did a study the other that they just released. 73% of folks under 30 have a smartphone. And that's closing the gap between folks living in poverty and not having access to technology and information. So how do we use these kinds of things? I'll just give you a couple examples. Over in Madison, Wisconsin, they created a phone app where you can check in with your counselor if you're going through CD treatment instantly. We are just about to launch a human services app that will help people navigate our human services system in Olmsted County. In about 2 weeks, you will be able to get it off Google Play. And it's a way for people real easily to hit a few buttons and get to the right place at the right time. There'll be a map it function, an instant button right to our intake, so there's easy access for folks to get things. And I can tell you nationally, the apps are popping up. We've got to start thinking about our service system in a little different way. Technology is coming at us a different way. Let's use it to our advantage. So I think with that, I think our comments are.
Okay, thank you. We have a question from Representative Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Fleissner, I was concerned when I heard about the father that had died in one of the facilities and the child calling in and saying he was thankful that the mm-hmm. parent had somewhere to go. Mm-hmm. Right away, I was wondering, why was that individual not with the family members?
Right. Well, Mr. quite honestly, excuse me. Madam Chair, Representative Franson, most of these folks in this home have become completely disenfranchised from their families. The wreckage that they'd probably created in their lives, there wasn't a connection there. They'd long separated from them. That's why they were living under bridges and that kind of thing when we started working with them. So, but still, when they found out their parent had passed, that's why they called. That's still better than so. There wasn't necessarily a great relationship there, or any relationship necessarily.
Anything further? Okay. Representative Abler.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. Maybe you remember this. These pilots are great. We've talked about this. And wasn't there a proposal to make this statewide? And did that get snagged, or did it get passed, or did DHS not want to do it? Or remember what happened with that?
Mr. Fleissner.
I can try that one. Madam Chair, Representative Abler. I think the way I understand it was our pilot, quite honestly, would be really hard to make go statewide. We have a really awkward funding mechanism to make this happen. We did it, quite honestly, because we were frustrated and wanted something different. And the two new pilots that are going on, I think, are the compromise about where we're going with things. And they really embody the whole idea of embedding this in the healthcare system, treating it as a chronic condition. And the three counties that are going to be involved in that, I really think, are probably a better model than ours. Ours was a baby step. Theirs is a bigger leap.
And which counties are those, Mr. Fleissner?
I don't know if they've selected the counties or if it's public yet. I've heard rumors, but I don't think I'll testify to rumors.
Okay. Okay, thanks. I guess they're not yet selected.
Madam Chair.
Okay, yes.
And just remember, as they go forward with this kind of thing, part of the challenge is blending the silos of money, because there's all this money being spent on these people, and some of it's county money, which is actually property taxes, and then you got the federal money and the state, and so that's the challenge. But anyway, I'm glad you've had success. Thanks for piloting the pilots, and we'll keep plugging away. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Ward. Ward, then we've got Quam, then we've got Franson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also want to thank you for your testimony. And it's hard to measure what didn't happen, but one of the things that you mentioned public safety a little while ago, but that doesn't seem to be incorporated in terms of the investment, the savings in terms of public safety. And I wish Representative Schoen was here because he could speak to this better than I can. But the money that's not spent on public safety issues because people are in treatment and they are in safe housing and things like that is not inconsequential. It leaves our officers and other police, public safety officials in a better position to be taking care of other issues, and I think it creates a safer community for all of us. And I'm sure that's part of what the family was feeling too, that this man who died was at least in a safe place. Exactly. And we didn't have to have police investigations and things like that. So it's pretty complex, but I'm wondering if there's some way to incorporate the public safety savings in your reports as well.
Mr. Fleissner.
Madam Chair, Representative, and I'm sorry I can't see your name tag.
Ward.
Yes, there is. In fact, our study before this, we did do police calls related to those clients, and we're in the process of looking at those police calls now, which are virtually none. And the hard part is getting data in terms of those costs of a police call. They don't Sheriff's Office don't provide that. So we know we made an impact. It's a little hard to put on.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to remind the committee, I think you've heard about the program before, that one of the counselors that was involved in the original grant to help out the expectant mothers with dependency issues, I talked with him when he had the grant. I talked to him when the grant disappeared, and there was concern. The county stepped up, provided the funds because it was a great program, and then the state did come with funding after that. But when we do these seed grants, oftentimes we don't seem to have the follow-up to see if it was a good program. And I'm glad the county saw it was a good program, continued it. But it'd be nice if we had some sort of a feedback system on these things that work. Because, frankly, the world changes. And new approaches and, you know, these wonderful programs that are tried on a shoestring, we really need to look at them. Some don't work, but some do, and I'm glad to see this one worked. The county kept it going, and then the state noticed and took care of it.
Right, and just a little editorial comment, Representative Quam. I think that partly when we have budgets that are this boom and bust type of a cycle, it kind of leads to that, because as we know in Health and Human Services, we often are, you know, told, cut your budget. And that means often cutting off some things that actually are beneficial and save money. And you're right, I don't think we have a very good overall way of evaluating what really works and what doesn't. So we got a lot of work to do there. But I think that you know, having a more rational system for dealing with our finances is probably a one good step toward that. So let's see, Representative Franzen had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Fleissner and others, you know, I can't possibly imagine, I don't think I could possibly imagine having a chemical dependency problem, and most people that start using don't go into it thinking they're going to become dependent. And then when they do, they don't think that there's any hope for them. And I just want to put my plug in before I move in, but that Teen Challenge does offer a hope for a future. Without substituting one legal drug for a prescription drug, mm-hmm. that can obtain sometimes the same effect that they're getting, only the government then is providing a legal high for them. So I'm just kind of the four drugs that you have listed. Mm-hmm. I didn't really look at all of them, but I did notice that Suboxone mm-hmm. can be used to get high, mm-hmm. and so what I don't want to see is an issue that we have here in the state of Minnesota, much like with the methadone issue,
sure.
Creating an epidemic in those areas where those facilities are located. So do you have a plan?
Madam Chair, Representative Franzen, as far as a plan, my plan would be that those drugs are administered by doctors in integrated fashion with treatment programs. Because there's research that shows they work in the right circumstance. You got to be careful who you give them to, and that's not the answer for everything. And I would agree with you, Teen Challenge, it works for a part of our population as well. But we've also had people that have gone to Teen Challenge and it hasn't worked. So, and they're opening a large program in Rochester very soon, and we're excited about that. But not any one thing works in this field, and I think that's why we need an array of services. And we need a system. Right now, as many people mentioned, there's a bunch of these different silos. And we have to integrate, and I believe integrating with healthcare is the best approach.
Okay. Any other questions, members? I think we're going to end at 11, and it's just a few minutes, too. So this has been very informative. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And And just a little housekeeping business, members, if you want to put in for per diem, the forms are going to get handed out for you to take care of that. And we're going to be meeting members of both committees, or just ours? Health Policy Committee members are going to be also meeting at 12:30 in this room for our second hearing of the day to learn more about particular chemical dependency issues. So with that, we are adjourned.